You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 7. Today, we're talking about resilience, well-being, and success. On the show today, we have not one, but two incredible guests. Based on her experience as the mother of children with severe heart conditions, our first guest left a successful recruitment career to become a happiness and resilience speaker, author, and laughter yoga leader. She has been interviewed on BBC Breakfast, ITV Calendar News, BBC and other radio stations all over the UK and featured and quoted in various publications, including The Guardian. She is also a Huffington Post blogger and author of the book Recipe for Happiness. She is studying towards an MSc in Applied Positive Psychology at Anglia Ruskin University. Our second guest represented Australia at 2 Paralympic Games and won 3 Paralympic medals. She is now an inspirational speaker and author of Ditch the Arm, Keep the Leg, and has written for The Guardian, Huffington Post UK, and Innovate My School blog. She has also been interviewed on TV and radio. She is studying towards an MA in Character Education at the University of Birmingham's Jubilee Centre for Character and Virtues. Our guests work together on RWS, which stands for Resilience, Wellbeing, Success, which is a character education programme. Their mission is to improve the resilience and well-being of pupils so that they can achieve success in all areas of their lives and to create change in education to make well-being and mental health a priority. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Frederica Roberts and Elizabeth Wright.
Good morning. Hello.
Hi there.
And I am just so fascinated to hear both of your stories because I think there's so much in there that, you know, it just makes great human stories. So, Frederica, would you mind telling us a little bit more about the path through being a mother of children with severe heart conditions and how that has led you to be doing what you are doing today?
Yes, of course. My daughters, who are now 17 and 19, were both born with severe heart conditions. And we discovered this with our eldest daughter, Charlie, when she was born. So when I had my 20-week scan, there were bits of the heart they couldn't see properly, but everything they'd seen looked fine. So they just said, we'll take a good look at her when she's born. And when she was born, it was very apparent that everything was not okay because she was very blue and she was immediately rushed into the special care baby unit. And with Hannah, our youngest, because obviously by then we had a child with a heart condition, they were even more cautious. They immediately referred us for a heart scan halfway through the pregnancy, and they picked up that she had a very severe condition. That basically they said there were very few people in the world that had it, and there was nobody alive in the world over the age of 20 with that condition at that point.
Goodness.
So the advice at the time, and I'm very glad to say we didn't take the advice, but the advice at the time was to have a termination. They told us she would have a miserable life, that she'd be in and out of hospital all the time, and that really it wasn't going to be a great life for her. Now there's actually a lot more children in hospitals with her condition, which is called pulmonary atresia. She was born effectively without a pulmonary artery, which connects the heart and the lungs, so it's a fairly essential part of the heart and lung system, but back then it was really quite rare. Luckily, through a long convoluted story, but basically through a friend of my mum's who knew a surgeon in the UK who happens to be one of the best in the world and was only based at Birmingham Children's Hospital, which isn't too far from where we live in South Yorkshire, and also my husband's family's from Birmingham, so it was very handy as well. He sort of said, well, okay, we'll take a look, we can't make any promises, but if you can get yourself scanned by my cardiologist, we'll take a look. And they told us she was at the worst end of the scale for her condition, but that they'd do what they could if we wanted to go ahead with the pregnancy. So she was, they thought they were going to have to operate within days of her being born, but as it happened, she wasn't actually at the worst end of the scale. It was still pretty serious. So she had her first open heart surgery when she was 10 and a half months old. She had her second open heart surgery at the age of 14, just before she went into year 10 at school. Charlie, our eldest, had her open heart surgery just before she started school. She was nearly five at the time. So they've both been through the mill a little bit, and we with them. They've both also had out-of-hospital cardiac arrests. Hannah, when she was 10 days old, she had a lung condition called bronchiolitis, which she got as a result of a very nasty cold virus. And she stopped breathing, and then her heart stopped. By some kind of I'm not a particularly religious person, but I do use the word miracle because I can't think of another word to describe it, really. The midwife was coming for a 10-day checkup at my house, and she arrived just as Hannah stopped breathing and was able to resuscitate her, and then she was taken to hospital. So that was our first sort of real horrible brush with an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And then Charlie, when she was 12, had a cardiac arrest at 7 o'clock one morning when she was supposed to be getting up and going to school. And the only reason we knew it had happened was because it was 7 o'clock and her alarm was going off and she didn't get up. So I found her blue and clammy and not breathing with no heartbeat. And again, you know, the series of events that somehow made it possible for her to survive is incredible. She spent 8 days in an induced coma. And then 8 more days in hospital when they had to find a way to kind of prevent it happening again. They fitted her with a state-of-the-art defibrillator that sits under the skin because the kind of normally they would fit a pacemaker, which is quite a standard procedure, but the surgery she'd had when she was four had closed off one of the veins that they would normally use for the pacemaker, so they couldn't do that, so they had to find a different way. So they fitted this defibrillator, and all being well, she's had it changed now 6 years after the first one, and this one should last her another five or six, and so it goes. And it's just amazing that despite all of that, we've got one daughter who's just finished her first year at university, studying exactly what she wanted to do and having an amazing time, and another daughter who's just finishing year 12 now, and we're actually going to her first two university open days, Friday and Saturday this week. To sort of, and she wants to become a doctor, and she wants to use her experience to actually hopefully become either a cardiothoracic pediatric surgeon or in any case work with children as a doctor. Through all of those experiences, I was like many other mums. I was working. I started off. I was actually a teacher at the time. In fact, I'd gone back. I'd taken a break, obviously wanting to have my family. And then, having trained as a teacher straight after university, I took my first teaching job just before Hannah had her surgery. She was on a waiting list, and I thought, well, I can either go back now in September, or I can wait another year and go back in September. So I'll go back now, and we'll just take it as it comes, and when we get a date, we get a date. And I'd been in school 2 weeks and I got the call, so they said, can you come in next week? So I missed the first 6 weeks of my first teaching job in a very challenging school, and I went back, and it was a nightmare. I'll be honest, it was an absolute nightmare. Changed schools, that was a nightmare as well. So I ended up leaving teaching, and through all of that, so then I eventually ended up in recruitment as a career choice. Obviously, I decided I wanted less stress, and then somehow decided recruitment was going to be it, and that ended up being a really successful.
And I'd started doing some races at the school swimming gala and was really enjoying it. And when I was 13, it was announced that Sydney, Australia had won the right to host the 2000 Olympic and Paralympic Games. And where they were going to be at Homebush was literally 10 minutes down the road from where I grew up. So, you know, we were really, really excited that we're going to have the Olympics and Paralympics in our home city. And of course, I did what I think every child, or almost every child, probably does at some point. I turned to my mum and dad and said, I'm going to swim at the Paralympics and I'm going to swim at those games. I don't know if they quite believed me at that point. But, you know, to be honest, Lucy, I felt, you know, even at the age of 13, such a passion and emotional connection to this dream that I had. You know, this focus and determination that I could feel bubbling away to actually achieve this goal, it was so strong. And I guess you could say I really nagged my parents and nagged for them to find me a coach. And so they found me a coach, and I started training, and
Was that coach, did that coach specialise in working with people with disabilities, or were they a, you know, a normal swimming coach?
Okay, at this point, in my entire swimming career, I had two coaches, but my first coach, Alan, he specifically worked with children with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So, but he was my coach for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful for having met him, because the belief he had in me, literally to the point that 6 months after I started training with him, he said to me, "I think you're ready to swim at the New South Wales State Championships," which would have been the biggest competition I would have swum at thus far. And mm-hmm. And for him to have this belief, he absolutely believed me when I said I was going to swim at the Paralympics, and he was, I think, as equally determined as I was to get me there.
Mm-hmm.
And training is tough. I think what a lot of people maybe, I don't know whether they realise how tough training actually is, but, you know, especially as a swimmer, you're up at 4:30 a.m. every morning, down at the pool for 2 hours. And when you're still going to school at that point, you're then going off to school for 6 hours, and then you're back in the pool again in the afternoon for another 2 hours. It's a lot of hard work, yeah, and a lot of effort, and you have to really be dedicated and also be willing to give up a lot of stuff. I gave up a lot of, you know, I was 13 when I started this, and, you know, it's, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, you're starting to want to go out more with your friends, mm-hmm, and go to parties and stuff like that. And I gave up a lot of that to essentially achieve what I really, really had my heart set on achieving. And, you know, it's really, you know, to have started training at 13 and have parents who eventually got on board and completely backed me the rest of the way, you know, especially my dad getting up to take me training at 4:30 yeah, in the morning. I
that's a big thing as a parent. That's a big thing.
Yeah, it would be a massive thing as a parent. You know, to my coach, to Alan, who really took me through those first 5 years, to ultimately take me to my first Paralympic Games at the age of 16 in Atlanta in the US. So, you know, that was only 3 years after I set my initial goal. So, you know, I flew to Atlanta for my first Paralympic Games. And I actually flew there with this idea that I didn't want to win any medals, because I didn't want that pressure, and it wasn't my main aim. My main aim was always Sydney.
Okay.
So I kind of really shocked myself, and I think I shocked my coach and my parents, and that when I actually walked away with a bronze medal in my, wow, first Paralympic final ever in the 50 metres butterfly.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was a real shock. I think.
Do you think
that
was partly to do with not putting any pressure on yourself?
I think so, definitely, in a way. All I said to myself when I was walking into the races in Atlanta was just to swim personal best times. If I could swim personal best times, mm-hmm, I would be happy, because, you know, that's me having done my best.
Yes.
If I came dead last in that particular race, it doesn't matter, as long as I'd done the best that I could.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what you should be training for, is just to be the best swimmer or the best athlete or the best student, whatever it is that you want to be. It shouldn't matter whether you come first or last. It should be the fact that you know in yourself that you've given it the best shot that you possibly could. And that was all I wanted to do. I just wanted to take my best shot at it and see what happened. So to actually finish that race and turn around and see the number 3 next to my name, it was a real shock, an exciting shock, but a real, yeah, shock.
Okay, fast forward us to Sydney then, and tell us what happened at Sydney.
Yeah. So I got to Sydney, and I think after having that taster of a medal in Atlanta, at that point I wasn't just wishing I'd do a personal best. I was really hoping that I'd walk away with a few medals at that point. And my very first race in Sydney was the same one as I had in Atlanta. And I really wanted to win that race. I really had my heart set on winning this 50-meter butterfly. And I remember, you know, I made the final and I walked out onto pool deck ready to win this race. And I dove in, swam the race of my life. I swam a personal best time, and turned around and saw where I came, and I came fourth. So, you know, at that point, it was a real disappointment. But but I guess I could say also at that point, I managed to cultivate that skill, I guess, to acknowledge, you know what, yep, I'm disappointed, but it's time to shake that off and focus on what is coming up next. And my next race was the 400 meter freestyle, and in that race I was ranked at that point 15th in the world, so I didn't even think I would make the final. But I was very fortunate, a bit I guess it's a bit sneaky in a way, that a few of the other swimmers pulled out of the race, and it actually meant that we were going straight to a final. So I didn't even have to contend with a heat.
Okay.
I was straight to the final, but still ranked 15th in the world. So I didn't think I would win a medal at all. But I went into that race with the race plan that I had from my new coach, who's called Ross. By this point, I'd been with him for 2 years. And I swam, really, that ended up being the race of my life. I swam a huge personal best and actually walked away with the silver medal. So went from being ranked 15th in the world to beating the top five in the world and walking away with the silver medal.
Wow.
Which was absolutely an amazing experience in my hometown.
Yes.
You know, with my family up in the stands, and I still remember my little nephew with his little sign going, "Go, Aunty Liz." And stuff like that. Really special moment. That wasn't the end of my games, as much as it's kind of like, you know, be the nice kind of cherry on top. I still had a few more races to swim, and one of those races was the 4x50 freestyle relay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a race where we were actually expected to win. We didn't quite win. We did come third, but I still see that very much as a gold medal winning race for us, because as a team we worked so amazingly well together.
Mm-hmm.
We did the best that we could for each other, and we didn't give up. And I think, you know, there's kind of all of these themes and ideas and concepts that I learned through swimming, both to do with teamwork and leadership and goal setting and goal achieving and success, and that has really kept me in good stead throughout the rest of my life, and things that I've taken on to other adventures and journeys that I've had. So I retired from swimming after the Sydney Games at the ripe old age of 20.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I get a lot of looks from people when I say that. But I'd achieved my goal. You know, I'd set this goal when I was 13, and I'd achieved it, and I'd actually exceeded what I wanted to achieve. So, you know, I was happy to kind of let that go and move on to kind of new adventures in life, which kind of, you know, took me a few years to discover what I wanted to do. But eventually I went to university to study fine art, which is a complete leap from sport to art kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I applied the same principles that I had throughout swimming to actually achieve success in my fine art degree. So I ended up finishing with first class honours in my fine arts degree and actually coming top of my year, which meant that I then got offered a scholarship to do my Masters of Philosophy. So I've also done my Masters of Philosophy degree in fine art as well. And it was at that point that I moved to the UK to start my PhD, but due to some medical issues, I had to kind of let my PhD go for a time. And that was when I started speaking in schools, because I started to think, you know, if I could achieve all this stuff and using these things to achieve my dreams and my goals, then why not get out there and try and help other children recognize that they could achieve things as well, which is ultimately led me to working with Fred or Frederica in with RWS and ultimately going back to uni, not to finish my PhD but to do an MA in character education, because ultimately I'm interested in what was within me character-wise that got me to have this focus and this determination and dedication to set out and achieve stuff, but also beyond that in terms of what is in all of us that can actually help us lead flourishing, thriving lives in all areas of our life.
I think that's fascinating. And so much of what you've said there, Liz, I, you know, really resonate with from what I do as a study skills coach. And, you know, talking about firstly, yeah, your motivation coming first, and that very much came from you and no one else. And that's something I talk about all the time with my students. And it's what the first chapter of my book is all about, is really, what is your motivation? Yeah. Why are you doing this? And without that, you know, yes, really not much is going to happen. And then that self-belief, exactly, and exactly, the belief from outside and the dedication, all that flows from that motivation, and I think that's fascinating. The question I want to ask you, Liz, and then I want to bring Frederica in to help answer it, is, did all this success in achieving your goals make you happy?
Yeah, I think it did. But, you know, I think in a way there were also some difficult lessons in that too, because, you know, for me, when I finished swimming, I had all that success in swimming, and then when I retired, it was almost like this plummet of, mm-hmm, of focus and, you know, it's essentially mood, I would say. I went through a time where I was feeling down. I started feeling I was crying for no reason, and, you know, I became really anxious. And I think in a way, because I'd had this intense focus for so long and this success came from it, and then to suddenly not have it was really tough. Mm-hmm. But ultimately it's those lessons that have helped me as I've gotten older to recognize that, you know, we're going to have ups and downs in life, and you can actually maintain a kind of contentment or happiness through that once you accept that, you know, you're going to have these amazing successes in life, but you're also going to have these tough moments to get through. But as long as you know what works for you to keep you up and keep you moving forward, then, you know, you'll be fine. You'll come out the other end fine. So
yeah. It's something I relate to, because I decided at the age of 9 that I wanted to study at Cambridge University, and I made it my mission, and I got there and I did my degree, and I came out the other side with absolutely, yeah, no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And it's really taken me, you know, nearly 20 years to work out, you know, yeah, what it is that, yeah, lights me up and what I love. And you know, it's, I suppose, joining Fred in here, it's how do you get through those times where you don't have that motivation and that direction, and maybe you're dealing with challenges like the challenges you dealt with, Fred, with your daughters. How do you stay happy? Like, how do you be a happy person no matter what?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think there's a difference between kind of being chirpy, yeah, and being kind of a happy person. And I, mm-hmm, think that's the main difference, that, you know, you can be happy as a person without being necessarily feeling on top of the world all of the time. And that's where the resilience kind of element comes in, I think, because if you're resilient, then it's knowing that, okay, you know, you will have, inevitably in life, you will have high points and low points. But if you know that you have the tools and techniques to bring you back, and we can't all be at a high point all the time, of course, that would be impossible. And also it wouldn't be a high point if we,
yeah,
were there,
just be normal.
Time.
Yeah.
So, and there's a lot of research, and Sean Acor's book, The Happiness Advantage, is fantastic in sort of drawing all of that research together in a very humorous way. So even, you know, I say research and some people might think, oh my goodness, you know, but it's not a research heavy book. It brings in a lot of really humorous examples. Okay. And Sean Acor, if anybody's watched his TED talk as well, he's a very humorous speaker as well. And he's, you know, he brings all of that together, and what he says right at the start of the book, and in his TED talk, is kind of the focus of everything that I've been doing throughout my life, which is that if you keep focusing on when this happens, I'll be happy, and when that happens, I'll be happy. I'll be happy when I get my degree. I'll be happy when I get that medal. In my case, you know, I'll be happy when I lose weight, or you know, I'll be happy when my girls are 100% healthy. Well, that's never going to happen, you know. There are certain things that can and can't happen, but also you set yourself these goals and you think, I'll be happy when I achieve that. And then, as Liz described and as you described, you get to that goal and there's this sense of anticlimax,
yeah,
of, well, I've got here now what? Whereas actually, if you work on your happiness first, mm-hmm. and kind of accept that, you know what, I can be happy, and if I get that and I achieve that, that's great, and that will make me feel really on top of the world, and that's icing on the cake, but I don't depend on that outcome for my happiness.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Then actually, yeah, that's where you can actually be. And that's, I suppose, how I've, I mean, there are specifics, and I don't know when you want to kind of, whether this is where to go into. I suppose the first one would be, you know, it's something that is written about and talked about a lot, but it's gratitude. And it's kind of allowing you to put things into perspective when things go wrong and when things go well, mm-hmm. To some extent that, you know, when things go amazingly well, it's not entirely 100% of your doing either, that there is a certain element of luck, but there is a lot of hard work and things that go into that as well. So it's a combination. But that when everything goes wrong, sometimes there are things out of your circumstances, things like other people's health, etc., and the economy overall, whatever, you know, if you're thinking about people trying to get a job, for example, when they leave school and stuff, there are circumstances sometimes that are outside of your control, but you can still control your response to those circumstances, yeah. And you can control how you deal with that. And one of the things that you can do, therefore, is to deliberately practice gratitude. Now, before I started looking into positive psychology, I'd never deliberately practiced gratitude, but I'm aware that it's something that got me through. So when, for example, Charlie, our eldest, was diagnosed at birth, mm-hmm. I was obviously, like any new parent, you know, you kind of, when it comes down to it, I mean, you might have dreams about whether you want a girl or a boy or what you might do with them when they get older and mm-hmm. the outfits and all of this. But ultimately, when it comes down to, you know, you think you want a healthy baby.
Yes.
That's what you want. You want a healthy baby. And my first baby was born with all these expectations and this hope, and suddenly she was taken away from me. And taken actually to a different hospital in a different city the next morning at 5 o'clock. They wheeled her past my bed to say goodbye. I'd had an emergency cesarean section, so I couldn't go with her. So I'm there lying in bed, unable to move. And they said, right, say goodbye to your daughter. She's going off to Leeds, 30 miles away. And my world was crumbling. Mm. And then it's kind of, how do you make sense of that? And how do you try and kind of still be in a place where you can function? And once I was obviously reunited with her, luckily only 2 or 3 days later, you know, I really needed to function. I wanted to breastfeed her, and you can't do that when you're really stressed and unhappy. No. And I wanted to enjoy, and that was I remember making this conscious decision, which was, well, I can focus on everything that's gone wrong and how unfair this is, because it is really unfair. Or I can focus on, do you know what? There are lots of people who can't have kids, and we have this amazing, beautiful daughter. Mm. And, okay, she's going to have challenges, and we're just going to have to get through them. But hopefully not every day will be a challenge. And the good days, we will make the absolute best of the good days. And we will enjoy every moment for however long it lasts. Mm-hmm. And we'll deal with the problems as they come, and we'll deal with them when they come. And it was that kind of... For me, it was, and I know it's my husband's the same, we kind of compartmentalized our life at that point. And it became the same when Hannah came along. And when I knew that she was safe while I was pregnant for the rest of the pregnancy, but we had this nightmare looking forward to, we didn't know what was going to happen, I made sure that I enjoyed every moment of the pregnancy, even the most unpleasant aspects of pregnancy, the sleepless nights, yeah. And everything. You know, I thought, I want to enjoy this because I know she's safe. I know she's safe right now, and this is my time with her. And so we've got this kind of way of compartmentalizing our lives, and we have in hospital mode and out of hospital mode. And when we're in hospital, then that takes priority, and you worry and you cry, and your darkest thoughts go wherever they need to go, because they do. Mm-hmm. But you kind of hold on to hope. And then when we're out of hospital, it's like, right, okay, normal life, and everything else is on the back burner, because there is no point. And that was the decision, you know, there is no point worrying about what might happen, what might be, what could have been different. I wish. It does, you know, it's not, it is what it is. And actually that's led us to having a very normal, happy, healthy family life, which means, you know, we shout at each other, we shout at the kids, they shout at us, doors get slammed, all the usual stuff that you would expect. They've never been wrapped in cotton wool. I remember when Hannah used to struggle to go to sleep at times, and she'd have proper screaming fits and everything, and she would turn grey, and she'd go all mottled and clammy.
Goodness, that's scary.
And I was determined. It was really scary, but I was determined not to make a rod for my own back, yes, and to keep going in there. So I'd be literally with my ear glued, one ear to her door and one to a baby monitor to listen for breathing. Yeah. But I would let her sort of, you know, cry it out when I knew that there was nothing wrong, and do the whole controlled crying that they advised of going in after so many minutes, and all of that, because I was determined they were just going to be brought up as if there was nothing wrong with them, which is, of course, what Liz said her parents did with her as well. Bring her up to be independent, etc. And I think that's really paid off. And when you look at gratitude, you know, I think, well, if my daughters hadn't had the experiences they've had, they would maybe have a very different outlook on life. They've always been mature beyond their years in a lot of ways. And I remember when Charlie was doing her GCSEs, and this is probably quite relevant to the students that you work with, mm-hmm, as well. You know, Charlie was doing her GCSEs, and her form tutor said to her, are you worried at all? And she said, well, I had heart surgery at the age of 4. It nearly killed me, but I'm still here. I had a cardiac arrest when I was 12. It nearly killed me, but I'm still here. Do you know what? It's just GCSEs.
Yeah, and it's really good to put things into context like that.
Care.
Yeah. Exactly. What I wanted to bring this back to, because, like, your stories are utterly amazing and really compelling, but they're not the standard experience of, you know, most parents and most students in schools.
Yeah.
So how can you bring the things that both of you are talking about back to kind of more normal existences, and how can you bring, like, the practice of gratitude and the resilience that you're talking about into the everyday life of those kind of people?
Well, one example was actually given to us by a couple of year six people in one of the videos that they did in a school we worked with, and they did us a little video at the end of the programme. It was really quite funny watching these two, because they kept going, they must have had a leak. One of them must have had a leak in their pipe at their house, because he kept coming back to this leak, and he kept saying, well, you know, if you've got a leak, and then the other girl was trying to bring in different examples, and he kept going, yeah, but if you've got a leak.
Children are funny, aren't
they? And they're saying, it's just a leak, you know, get over it, kind of thing. Yeah. And I think that kind of actually really summarized the everyday experience. We get so worked up about the most ridiculous things sometimes. We really do. As human beings, we're so capable of getting really wound up about things. And we sometimes think that things are the end of the world. And I'm not saying, you know, I mean, exams are by no way ridiculous or not meaningful. They are very important. Mm-hmm. They are very meaningful. And I fully understand why kids get so stressed about them. But getting stressed about them doesn't actually make them go any better.
No.
And the thing that they've got to remember is that actually, yes, they've got GCSEs or A-levels going on. And yes, a lot depends on that. But it's not the only thing that's happening in their lives.
Yeah. I wrote a blog post actually the other day about what to do when you get bored of revision. And in it, I said, be grateful. You know, you have an amazing opportunity. Like, I taught in a school in Uganda only for a week, and I saw, you know, classrooms of 50 children lined up at the gate, not being allowed in because their parents hadn't paid the fees. You know, they were desperate for an education, but they couldn't have it because their parents couldn't afford to pay for it. And, you know, the children in this country are so fortunate to be able to go to a free school and, you know, get this amazing education from brilliantly qualified teachers and have the privilege of proving what they know in exams and progress on to the next level. And actually, yeah, if you think of it like that rather than, oh, it's such a bore, then actually you're going to embrace it and, yeah, do a lot better with it.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's lots more that I can sort of touch on, but I'm conscious that I've been rambling on for ages. And I know that Liz can probably bring a lot of stuff into this as well, in terms of the success element that's probably quite relevant to the students that you work with as well, everyday life.
Okay, Liz, what can you tell us about resilience then, and your personal experience is, how it can apply to kind of normal GCSE and A-level students in this country?
I guess, you know, listening to Fred talk and thinking, you know, the kind of perspective that she comes from, and definitely what she talks about as part of the program that we run, and kind of trying to think of, okay, well, you know, I run the success part of the RWS program. Okay. And kind of within that, I actually kind of look at things that obviously you can work on within yourself to actually help you have success in life, and in the case of kind of the students that you work with exams and and schoolwork that they do. So, you know, kind of like I look at stuff such as goal setting and goal mapping, and there's quite a lot of interesting research out there and kind of new ways of actually setting goals and mapping goals to enable you to achieve, I guess, in that kind of realistic everyday kind of way. So I don't think Fred has mentioned this yet, but there is an intervention out there to do with actually resilience and well-being and feeling happier called, is it My Best Self, Fred?
It's Best Possible Self.
Best
yeah.
Possible Self. And I really, really love that intervention. It really does work. But there's a positive psychologist called Gabrielle Ottingen, and she actually took that intervention a step further, because she recognized and understood that as an intervention, My Best Possible Self helps you feel better about yourself and increases your level of well-being and happiness up to approximately 6 months. But she actually wanted to look at how you can then kind of using that intervention where you are imagining your best possible self in the future and how you can actually reach that. So she actually developed I guess you could call it a goal mapping system called WOOP, which stands for wish, outcome, obstacle and plan. And the first part, the wish and outcome, is essentially the my best possible self intervention. But the second part, where you're looking at obstacles and planning, is kind of embracing this concept that she has called mental contrasting. So you're looking at that my best possible self and that kind of excitement that brings and that motivation, I guess, to go, wow, you know, I really want to get there, but really anchoring it in, you could almost say, the reality or negatives that we face or obstacles that we face in our day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a system where you're actually keeping that dream, but you're also looking at what you have to overcome right here and right now, and how you can actually plan to overcome that so that you can eventually achieve that goal. And I kind of really like that as a goal setting system, not just for children but adults as well.
Yeah,
I think anyone can use it really successfully, and she's done a lot of research on it, and the actual really positive outcomes from the research that she's done in terms of increasing students' abilities to do even better in their academic work and in their tests, but also in other goals that they have in life, actually really, really increases and improves.
So when you talk about the obstacles, are you talking about forward planning, like anticipating what the obstacles would be and like almost being prepared for them coming your way so that you're able to deal with them more effectively than if they were just a surprise?
Yeah, absolutely. The way that you actually do WOOP is when you come to writing out the obstacles that you'll face, it could be looking at stuff that you are facing right now, but also imagining what obstacles you will face in the future. So say you set a goal for in a year's time, and you know that, okay, for example, it's say you have really important tests in a year's time and you want to plan to do really well because you want to go to university or something like that, but you can already start to map out, okay, well, you know, around Christmas time, I'm probably not going to, you know, have a lot of time to study or do anything like that because, you know, mum and dad are going to want to drag me off to family parties, or, you know, I'm going to be distracted by TV or whatever. So, you know what, I'm going to plan on how I'm going to cope with that and how I'm going to keep up my studies during that time. So it's kind of, yeah, even just really simple day-to-day obstacles that you'll face, yeah. As well as the bigger ones. And it's about planning, okay, how I'm actually going to overcome them. So when you actually are faced with those obstacles, instead of maybe panicking and having a bit of a meltdown in, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm coming off track for my goal. You can actually consider and go, you know what, actually, I know what I have to do to get through this obstacle. I know I can do it. I'll put that plan in place. and actually get through that particular time.
Yeah, it reminds me of something that people tell people who want to lose weight, and they're like, what are you going to do if somebody offers you a piece of chocolate cake? Like, actually have a plan of what you're going to say when somebody at some indeterminate point in the future offers you a piece of chocolate cake, and you have this response worked out in your head. No, thank you very much. You know, whatever it is that you plan to say, and it's much easier to react in the way you want to in that moment rather than kind of bowing to the pressure of the moment. And I think, you know, the things you're talking about for the students that I work with, things like their mobile phone and notifications and all that kind of thing, that's a real everyday obstacle for students achieving their goals. And actually, if they just think through, how am I going to deal with my phone? What is my system here to stop it from holding me back? And, you know, that's a really, really useful thing to think through in advance.
Exactly. So yeah, you might know that your friends get really talkative on Snapchat or something, you know, at a particular time in the afternoon, and but you know, you might think, okay, but that's when I study best. So you know what, I'm going to turn my phone off, or I'm going to put it away for the next hour, and then for 5 minutes I can come back on after that hour and have a quick look and catch up with everyone, and then maybe put it away again for another hour while I continue studying. So it's just about having these plans in place, but plans that work for you. So you know, what works for some might not work for others. So
yeah definitely. And I think the role of parents in all this who are going to be listening to this is kind of thinking, you know, how can they almost coach their children through making those plans? You know, what questions do they need to ask? Yeah. What do they need to anticipate to help their children build those plans to deal with the things that are going to get in the way of their dreams, really?
Yeah, and that's where I think having a system like WHOOP can actually help with that. I know you said you'll link through to Gabrielle and this mapping system and that, and I do know that there is kind of like, you know, a form or mapping kind of sheet that she has that actually has these questions that you can ask yourself, or even as a parent you can sit down with your child and kind of go through it with them. And but you know, essentially letting the child lead as much as possible, because well, we touched on it earlier, you know, in terms of that inner motivation, it has to come from the child or teenager. You know, as we know, kids dig their toes in if they're being told what to do by their parents.
Definitely. Definitely.
It's about letting them lead.
Right, so Fred, we haven't really talked much about emotional well-being or well-being of any kind. Can you talk to us about well-being and what parents can do to help promote their children's emotional well-being?
Of course, yes. So a lot of that, I think, works very well with the work of Barbara Fredrickson, and she came up with the broaden and build theory, which is very well supported. And what that theory says is basically that positive emotions can broaden your horizons, so that they make you see more opportunities, see more options, see more outcomes, and they also broaden your horizons in terms of relationships, so you get on with other people better, and that positive emotions build your resilience as well. So the more positive emotions you experience, the more resilient you become. And then another bit that she added to the broaden and build theory, so it became broaden, build and undo, is that positive emotions have the power to undo negative emotions. So the idea is really, as a parent, to try and help your child or your teenager to have as many positive emotions as possible. So it doesn't, you know, you can't negate the negative ones, but try and sort of overpower them with positive. And there's a number of ways that they can do this. So we've talked about gratitude already, so I'll park that one. There's things like, for example, kindness. So that's on two levels. So encouraging them to be kind to themselves, because we all do it as adults and kids do it very well themselves as well, beating ourselves over the head when we make mistakes. So, you know, if they've left it a bit late to start revising, beating themselves over the head about it is not actually going to help their positive emotions. Whereas encouraging them to just accept that they are where they are and that they can still make the best of where they are at that point and just focus from then on, rather than spending negative energy on thinking, I should have done more before now, is one way, for example, to be really kind to themselves as well. And also encouraging them to be kind to other people, because actually altruism is a really good way. I always say be selfishly selfless, because actually being altruistic is a great way to boost your own emotional well-being. So even if they're in the middle of revision and exams, you know, maybe that's a good time to give an hour a week to maybe volunteer in an old people's home to sit and chat to old people who maybe haven't got visitors, or to go and work in a charity shop, or in any other way kind of do something for other people, maybe even tutoring younger kids, because that's going to be a great way to actually boost their own knowledge as well in their subjects that they're revising. So there are lots of ways, and, you know, a lot of A-level students can tutor GCSE students. So that's another way. And so although it's seems counterproductive to take time away from their revision, that would be really powerful in terms of boosting their well-being and therefore then making them more productive as well. Now, you introduced me, you said I'm a laughter yoga leader, so it's no surprise that I'm a really big fan of laughter. But laughter is amazing. It stimulates the release of endorphins, which are happiness and pain releasing hormones. So that's an ultimately very simple and very quick and effective way to actually engender positive emotions, to actually laugh. And what laughter also does is it gets rid of excessive cortisol, which is a stress hormone, which of course, particularly at exam times, kids will have a lot of buildup of cortisol. So I'm not saying necessarily take them to a laughter yoga club. It's not for everybody, although it is great. But, you know, don't stop them when they want to watch the silly YouTube videos that make them laugh. Impose a time limit if you need to, but encourage them to do that and to watch comedians and all of that kind of thing, and just to spend time with their friends and have a good laugh, because that will really help to boost their emotional well-being. And linked into all of that as well, and it's a whole topic in itself, so I'll only touch on it, but there's a lot of stuff that they can do in terms of character strengths, in terms of discovering what their character strengths are and then using their character strengths to do the things they don't enjoy, for example. So it's a link that you'll be able to link to the notes. It's an organization that was led by Professor Martin Seligman, the VIA Character Institute, and they've done a lot on that. And there are questionnaires that are even aimed at 10 to 17 year olds, as well as the adult ones, that you can do to discover. Basically, there are 24 character traits that the researchers found that all of us have in some measure. They're universal all over the world, across different cultures, different ages. But the difference is that which order they're in. And so all of us have 5 signature strengths that are the sort of the strongest. And if we do everything we do with that in mind and use our key signature strengths, then it actually enables us to be emotionally in a better place. So for example, if you hate revising, but one of your signature strengths is curiosity, then a parent can try and tap into that curiosity strength to work with their child on the revision. So, you know, how can they be curious about what they're studying to actually help them? And the other thing they can actually do with strengths is to pick a strength out of those top 5 and find 7 new ways of using it over a course of 7 days. So one new way every day for
that
7 days.
Interesting.
It keeps it interesting. It's a bit of a challenge, you know. And one of the things it does is it actually, that can boost happiness and reduce depressive symptoms. And I think that was for up to 6 months in the research. That's a really powerful way that they can boost positive emotions and therefore boost well-being from an emotional point of view in their children.
That's really interesting, because it helps you. I talk an awful lot about how exams aren't really an end in themselves, but actually it's a journey that you go through, and you can learn an awful lot about yourself through how you approach it. And what you're talking about is, you know, you will learn so much about yourself if you experiment with those different methods and your different strengths, and, you know,
absolutely,
really find what works for you in a really, really positive way that you can carry forward into other areas of your life.
Exactly. And the other thing I would add is, you know, allow them as a parent, allow your children to still have time for their hobbies and encourage them to, because I know a lot of the time it's the kids that will retreat and say, oh, I haven't got time to go to that club, or I haven't got time to go to my drama group or this and that, and actually really encourage them to still do it. My youngest daughter, Hannah, still does all of that stuff, you know, even while she's in the middle of exams, choir and all of that. And she tells me it's what keeps her going and it keeps her sane.
Yeah, the thing she advise students to do is, you know, if you've got an awful lot on your plate and you can't fit it all, you just physically can't fit it all into the week, is choose the things that make you feel best about yourself.
Exactly. And exactly.
So those breaks that you're taking away from revision are actually building you up and making yourself believe in yourself as a person, like Liz was talking about really early on, you know, that self-belief and, you know, being happy and content with yourself is so important when you're trying to achieve something difficult that's pushing you outside your comfort zone.
Exactly. Do the things that make you feel good, you know, use that time, that downtime to do the things that make you feel good. That's absolutely it.
Fantastic. Well, that's really all about emotional well-being.
Yeah.
And I wanted to link back to Liz and talk about the physical well-being, because that's just as important, really, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, what can happen, especially for teenagers who are really focused on their studies and exams are coming up and they're not far away, is that you absolutely can forget that you have a body, and that if you actually do look after your body, it is actually going to help you look after your mind a lot better anyway. And you know, when we talk about physical well-being or physical activity, it's just about moving your body and getting the oxygen flowing and moving around and stretching those muscles and stuff like that. So it doesn't necessarily have to involve actually going out for a full day and running races somewhere or going and playing a big game of football somewhere or something like that. Quite often, especially the closer it gets to exams, the less time you actually have to go out and do that. It could be something as simple as you've been sitting at your desk studying for hours and hours and hours and you've got a bit of a crick in your neck and your back's a bit sore. Just stand up and do 10 minutes of some very simple stretches. Perhaps if you're interested in yoga or Pilates or something like that, even just something soft and gentle, you know, like that, that can actually just help to strengthen your muscles and give them a bit of a stretch and get your blood flowing and pumping around a bit, can just be really helpful in terms of keeping you healthy during times of stress. And obviously, you know, it's not just the looking after your body that exercise and stretching that can help you with, but it does also have a huge impact on your mental well-being and your mental health. And it's something that Fred and I are very aware of ourselves. You know, we're both self-employed. We both work really hard on our business and going into schools and delivering our WS into schools, that we have to be really mindful ourselves of our own physical health and, mm-hmm. and well-being and the impact that has on our mental health. And it's something that, you know, we're not just business partners, but we also go out and try and do a big decent walk at least once a week as well out in nature, because actually being out in nature, if you can get out in nature, can have a huge impact on your mental health and well-being. Just being around trees and birds and you know, bugs and dirt, flowers and stuff can have a huge, huge impact on your mental health and well-being, and also your ability to focus and really concentrate when you are studying for your exams. So, you know, I know it's something, I'm sure Fred agrees, that I couldn't do without our weekly walks.
And we make time for them, even when we sometimes think, because obviously we're both studying towards master's degrees, and quite often that's work at the weekend, and it's a case of, oh, I've got this assignment in, should we just cancel the walk? And then we go, no, we'll do the walk. We'll just get up a bit earlier, we'll do the walk, because we know that then we're actually going to work a lot better as well. So.
And I think the other thing with that as well, and I know, Fred, you probably remember this, but quite a few weeks ago, you know, I had an assignment due and I was really stressing over it. And actually going out for a walk with Fred and being able to discuss the issues I was having with the assignment with her helped give me a lot of clarity. And I really put it down to the fact that it was out walking in the fresh air and discussing over the issues I was having with a trusted friend. And it really helped me resolve the struggles that I was having with my own studies. So, you know, there's a multitude of benefits to getting out and exercising and having a stretch and getting some fresh air.
Definitely. And this is something I've talked a lot about on my blog already, and I will link to some posts about this. I've got one that's got 30 different ideas for active revision breaks, and some other ideas for kind of more mindful things that you can do during revision breaks. And I think those are really, really important. And I know myself, it's actually really important to give myself thinking time, and actually going for a walk, getting out in nature, going for a run or whatever it is, gives me that time to think and make those links between ideas and structure them in my head, so that when I come back, it's not all a jumble anymore. I've actually got something to write down in a kind of logical and coherent way on a piece of paper. So it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you both today. Your stories in themselves are amazing, and all the wisdom that you've shared with us has been absolutely fantastic. What I'd like to finish off with is, do you think there's any final, like, really short message you would like to give to parents or students about what they can do in terms of resilience, well-being, and well-being to lead to success in their school life? Let's go for Liz first.
Okay. I guess my final message would be out to the students, actually, and it's essentially just to trust yourself. I think a lot of the time we can overthink things and worry too much about stuff.
I think that's huge, trusting yourself and trusting that you have what it takes to do what you want to achieve. And there's a wonderful quote about, if the mind can conceive it, it is possible. That's not exactly what it is, but it's basically, if you can imagine it, you can make it happen. Okay, Fred, what about you? What's your parting words of wisdom for us?
I will give them a very practical tool that they can use, and they can use this when they're in the exam hall. And as sometimes happens, they get a complete mind blank and they go into complete panic mode, and they've forgotten everything they've revised because it happens. And what's happening at that point is their brain is basically, it's gone into panic mode, and it just can't allow them to think because the amygdala is taking over. It's going, you're going to die. And that's all it's doing. It's putting them into panic mode, and it's physically impossible to actually think rationally when your brain is in that mode. Mm-hmm. So you have to take your brain out of that mode very quickly. And a simple way to do that is the simplest breathing meditation in the world, even if they've never meditated before, but obviously if they've practiced this in advance. And it's to simply sit there, close their eyes, relax their shoulders as much as they can, and just take a really deep breath in to the count of four, hold it to the count of four, breathe out to the count of four, and just focus on the feeling of their breath and the rising and falling of their belly as they do that. And if they just take 10 breaths like that and count them in and out, so count in their head, obviously, count one as they breathe in and two as they breathe out, and three in, four out, etc., get to 10. If they find that they lose track because their mind is going into panic mode again, just start again at one. And then just do that until they can just get to 10 without focusing on anything other than counting to 10 and their breath. And that is all they need to do to calm the amygdala down and allow their brain to retrieve all the information that's in there that they've been revising for, and to get themselves back into what they're doing. And that's a really simple tool that they can use.
That's a brilliant, really practical thing to leave us with. Thank you so much for that. Right, just to finish off, where can people find you if they've been absolutely fascinated and captivated by what you've had to say today? What's your website and what's all your social media and all that kind of thing?
Our website is www.rws.today.
Okay.
So it's a really simple one. And our Twitter handle is rwsuccess. And our Facebook page, again, they should be able to find it with RW Success, but otherwise if they just search Resilience Wellbeing Success, they'll find us on there as well. And on our website anyway, there's the links to our Twitter, to our YouTube as well. There's some videos on there, some of them done by the kids giving the tips on what they've learned, and to our Twitter account, etc. So everything's on the website, which is rws.today.
Well, that's fantastic. And I will link to all those in the show notes, so it's really easy for people to find them and link through to them. Well, all it remains to say is thank you so much for sparing the time to chat to me today and to share all your wisdom with our listeners. And take care. Thank you.
Thank you
very much, Lucy.
Well, I hope you found that interesting and helpful. If you've got any questions and comments, please, as always, leave them on the show notes, which you'll find at lifemoreextraordinary.com/7, or post them in the Supportive Parents Successful Students Facebook group, or send me a tweet at Lucy C. Parsons. And I will, of course, link to both the Facebook group and my Twitter account in the show notes. Finally, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe in your podcast app and leave a review. Every review helps to spread the word to more people who will find the show interesting and helpful. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. Goodbye.